This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A manned mission to Mars is, of course, always a topic of continuing interest among space enthusiasts and big governments talking about how they're going to get there. And now, smaller private companies are popping up trying to stake a claim in that race to get to the Red Planet. And one of the companies receiving a lot of attention in the past few months is a Dutch company called Mars One. And they're drawing their crew from the general public. What makes them different is that they're only offering a one-way ticket. You go, you live, you die on Mars. And that hasn't stopped thousands of people from lining up. My next guest is one of those people. Chris Patil is a Mars One candidate from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Great to be here.
Thank you. Mars One announced yesterday that they need to push back their timeline by 2 years for financial reasons. Are you disappointed?
Yes, that's right.
Are you disappointed?
I confess that I am. It's important to realize why the delay is for 2 years. Mars One is currently in the process of soliciting investments that are going to fund the next 10 years and beyond of getting people to Mars and exploring the planet. Unfortunately, small delays early on can lead to large delays in launch because the launch window from Earth to Mars only opens up every 2 years and 2 months. So it looks like a deal with Lockheed is not going to be in place before the end of this summer. And as a result, we're going to miss a 2018 launch window and have to delay until 2020 a demo mission and a CommSat mission that were slated for 2018 originally and now have been pushed back for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about your interest in signing up. What motivates you?
I think my motivation goes back almost 30 years to being a young boy watching Carl Sagan's Cosmos, sitting on the floor of my family room and looking at the pictures coming back from the Viking landers and listening to Carl talk about the somewhat tantalizing and ambiguous results of astrobiology experiments on those landers and raising the possibility that life may have once existed on Mars. And, you know, in the way that young boys do, I decided that I wanted to go, that someday I would be the person to go and answer that question. And my interest in Mars dates back to that time.
Are you upset at all by recent stories about how this is underfunded, it's not really well thought out, things like that?
You know, I'm a trained scientist and I'm a skeptic. And so I obviously always want to know more detail about what's planned. And I have always wanted to know more. I think that one of the things that the tone of the criticism has disturbed me somewhat simply because people have forgotten to say yet. So, you know, yes, the funding isn't in place, but not yet. It isn't completely determined. All the mission specifications haven't been completely determined, but there's time. There's 10 years until the planned launch, now 12. And I think that people have been somewhat overly impatient with the project. It's a small organization trying to do something extremely audacious. And I would love to have a little bit more measured coverage and a little bit more patience on the part of the general public. But I understand the skepticism. And I think skepticism is both valuable and useful in planning something like this.
Well, we wish you good luck, Chris. Hope you get
Thank
off
you
on
much.
That on that mission. Chris Patil is a Mars One candidate from Cambridge, Massachusetts. What will
Thank
it? You're welcome. What will it really take for us to safely land a person on Mars and bring them back? In this case, what technology do we still need? My next guest is here to help piece this together. Sydney Doe is a graduate research assistant and doctoral candidate in aeronautics and astronautics at MIT. He joins us from there. And if you have questions you'd like to talk about going to Mars, and I'm sure there are plenty of them, 844-724-8255, our number. You can also tweet us at SciFry, SCIFRI. Welcome, Sydney, to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me on.
You gave the Mars One proposal a pretty thorough review. What did you think of it?
Let me take a step back and talk about why we did it. So as is the case with most of the public, we were quite interested to hear about the Mars One mission plan. And as engineers and researchers, we thought we'd look into it a little bit more. So the first step was we went to the technical literature to see what data we could find out there on about it. And unfortunately, we weren't able to find any information at all. So we thought, okay, let's do a study based on the available information that we do have. We tried to contact Mars One as well as their contractors, Paragon, on multiple occasions and couldn't get any data. So we thought, okay, we'll mine the Mars One website for all the information that we can get. And whatever information is missing, we'll use standard aerospace literature to build that. And so we went and did the analysis. And essentially the conclusion we came up with was that because the mission is a one-way mission, essentially has no end date, the cost grows over time. And the primary reason for that is because when you have a one-way mission, you need to continually resupply this colony with supplies from Earth. So over time, your technologies degrade, you need more spare parts, and they need to be sent from Earth. Because right now, we just don't have the capability to manufacture parts on the Martian surface. And so add to that the fact that you want to add more and more people at every single launch opportunity, so 4 people every 2 years after the first landing. That means you need more technologies and more spare parts and hence more rockets to launch them there. So the fundamental conclusion was that right now it's infeasible to do a one-way mission to Mars, essentially because the costs grow and unsustainably over time.
But it is, you think it is feasible to do a mission to Mars and back?
So right now, there's still a lot of technology development that's required just to get people into the Martian system. So if you look at NASA's current mission plan, they're planning to send people to orbit Mars by 2030. So that's just staying in orbit. That doesn't involve going down to the surface or coming back or anything like that. And even then, there are still many challenges related to doing that, including protecting crews from the harsh space radiation environment, increasing the reliability of your life support systems, and actually just testing out all the technologies that are required to keep your crew safe throughout the mission.
Yeah, because reading proposals for going to Mars, the radiation in space seems to be one of the major obstacles to getting people safely there, from solar flares, things like that.
That's definitely true. It was actually highlighted as the biggest technical challenge by a National Research Council report that came out in 2012. It's one of the biggest challenges. The other two challenges that make up the top three challenges involve in-space propulsion technologies and reliable life support systems.
Mm-hmm. Also, one of the biggest problems in the mission is something we don't think a lot about until our car breaks down, which is you need spare parts, right? You carry all those spare parts.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. And the need for spare parts grows as your mission duration increases. So you've always got to have contingencies beforehand. And if something goes wrong on the Martian surface, you can't just order one from your local spare parts store because it's just not there, right? So you either have to bring it along with you initially or pre and place it before you get there, or you have to wait until the next launch opportunity, which is 26 months from the time that you first get there, to get those spare parts to the surface of Mars. So you have to plan for all of that ahead of time. And that involves rigorous testing to understand the reliability of your parts so that you can budget for the number of spare parts that you actually need.
You left out one other option, and that is 3D printing.
Right.
Couldn't you print, we're talking 10, 20 years from now, they'll be very common, they'll be high tech, you could just about print anything you wanted to make.
Definitely. 3D printing has experienced many technological accomplishments over recent years. The issue is that most of the technologies that you would need spare parts for are very difficult to print. So, for example, we're talking about high-precision parts such as valves, and there's seals involved with that. You have various ion exchange beds, essentially reaction chambers and other reaction beds that are required to process your water and your air. And so right now, the technology is not there. Actually, a National Academies report recently came out late last year that basically did a survey of all the 3D printing technologies available on Earth and concluded that right now, the technology is not capable, even on Earth, to produce these parts, let alone in space. And then if you're talking about doing it on Mars, you need to send it to the Martian surface, test it out, and make sure that it works. And then you also have to account for the feedstock required for this. Is that coming from Earth, or are you mining that locally? And if you're mining that locally, then you need the systems to get that locally. But if you're bringing the feedstock from Earth, then you still have this supply chain from Earth. And hence, over time, as you need more spare parts, you need more feedstock. And hence, the cost also grows over time.
And couldn't you send that feedstock and other anticipated supplies in advance of getting to Mars and landing it there, and it's waiting for you, the stuff that you would need? Like a cargo ship,
you definitely could. Exactly. Yeah, you definitely could. But again, you have to budget for that ahead of time, which requires a lot of technology development to understand how many spares you need to keep you alive between resupply opportunities so that you can budget for it.
Mm-hmm. And that's a big word, the B or the M word for money. Who's gonna pay for a mission to Mars? I mean, there are people saying that, not just the United States, but, you know, I think China and India people. And even Elon Musk says he could go to Mars with his spaceships.
Yeah.
Is there enough money? Or do you need that one person or one organization could do it?
It's a really tough problem, sending people to Mars, and it's going to require a ton of technology development over many decades to ensure that your technologies are reliable so that people can rely their lives on this, whether it be for a month, 500 days, and the rest of their lives. But obviously, it gets more difficult the longer you need to operate and rely upon these technologies. Nope. So in terms of funding it, you know, a lot of people say that it's going to have to be a multinational effort. It's really hard to say where the money's coming from. It's likely somehow you're going to have to monetize spaceflight so that there's a profit to be made, so that commercial interests can start investing into this endeavor.
Mm. Let's go to the phones. 1-844-724-8255. Let's go to El Paso, Texas. James, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. I was listening to all the technical problems being brought up with propulsion and life support, and it just kind of dawned on me that, you know, eventually those will be answered. I mean, those are not end-all problems to the mission. In my opinion, is it not the human psyche? I mean, how do you train for this mission that's going to take, you know, 2+ years to get out there, the isolation of being alone with, what, only 3 other crew members?
Yeah.
I mean, the testing of such a thing, would that not, you know, strain the individual enough that, you know, when they're actually put in the scenario, it, you know, could create problems?
Yeah, there's an old Twilight Zone that I think of. The first Twilight Zone was that scenario about somebody going a little nutty being isolated for all that time. What do you think, Sydney?
Yeah, so that's definitely a big concern. Space psychology is a very big area. I just want to take a step back regarding the technology. So these are challenges, and they can be overcome. So there's two separate issues that we're talking about here. We're talking about Mars One, or we're talking about just spaceflight in general. So in spaceflight in general, space psychology is a very big deal. We do a lot of analog testing on Earth in enclosed environments, and we've made observations. So for example, over time, you know, a team might get along to get together with each other very well initially, but over time, the little annoyances of each person can grow. And the fact that if it's a one-way mission, there's no way to get away from this person for the rest of your life, that can really damage the probability of success of the mission. With regard to my previous point about the technology, one of the fundamental underlying assumptions that Mars One has made is the fact that their mission plan only utilizes existing available and validated technology. And that's their justification for why their mission cost is so low. Except the word validated has a very clear, crisp meaning in engineering circles. It means that the technology has been proven to be capable and perform as advertised in the intended operating environment through the validation, through testing, proved through testing in the environment. So we can get there in terms of the technologies. They have to be tested in the environment first. And because we've never done such an endeavor on Mars, all the technologies right now have not yet been validated. And so there is this question of where is the budget for the development of these technologies, and how's that accounted for in the schedule?
Right. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Sydney Doe, graduate research assistant and doctoral candidate in aeronautics and astronautics at MIT. You know, I remember being around in the 60s when I was a kid for the space race, and they basically had a timeline, they had a schedule, and they had to develop these certain technologies at a certain rate. They had to be done, and they got them done.
Yeah, that's correct. And they did with, at times, 4% of the U.S. budget and a workforce of 400,000 people. Interestingly, the divorce rate during that time was one of the highest in the U.S. because so many husbands were devoted to the program, and also many women contributed significantly. So, for example, the Apollo Guidance Computer, one of the people who really pioneered the development of robust software for that was a female scientist at MIT here, actually.
Mm-hmm. So you're really saying that if you have enough money and you have enough manpower, woman power, and then the technology, mm-hmm. you can get it done. It's just a matter of commitment, committing all the resources.
So it depends on what you're talking about, what you're getting done.
Yeah.
If you're talking about a one-way mission, we can't do that right now and anywhere in the near future.
Well, let's talk about a return mission. Let's talk
right.
about return mission.
Yeah, you definitely could. But again, it would require significant technology development. And part of it is the testing takes a long time because the further away you get from Earth, the less opportunities you have to go to these destinations and do these tests. And so with money and time, we can get it done.
Mm-hmm. Are you confident we will? Or?
Yeah, I mean, we're all supportive of human spaceflight here. You know, I spend every day thinking about this. You know, in my research group, all of the members dedicate our lives to doing research to help support these efforts and enable these future endeavors. So
yeah.
we do believe that it'll one day get done.
All right. I hope you're right. I hope I'm around to see it. Thank you, Sydney.
You're very welcome.
Sydney Doe is a graduate research assistant and a doctoral candidate in aeronautics and astronautics at MIT. We wish you well on your doctorate there. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a break. And after the break, we're going to look at that. There are mysteriously warm waters. I mean, these are really warm waters off the west coast of the United States. And it's triggering starvation in marine mammals and birds. Strange things are happening in the waters. We'll talk about it after this break. Stay with us.